brother.
Oh,
what's up?
This is a groovy party, man.
Yeah,
I can dig it.
Stop right on.
All right. Good morning and welcome to the Earl Ingram Show. As always, you can join us at 844-967-2789. That's 844-967-2789. You can text us at that same number. How you doing, Connor? We can't hear you.
I said I'm doing all right. Sorry about that.
Yeah, that's all right, man. You're living for the weekend, I take it.
Yep. I'm happy it's here, well, almost at least.
Yeah. What are the plans for the weekend, man?
Let's
see, Sandy. A young guy, 20 years old. I'm asking him I can't hear you, Sandy. We let's see if we can hear you now, Sandy.
I don't think he wants to tell us.
All right. Here we are. We've got Sandy. Good morning to you, Sandy. How you doing?
I'm good. How are you?
All right. When you asked a 20-year-old guy, what are his plans for the weekend? And he doesn't jump up bubbling. You say, hey, wait a minute. If you asked me at 20 years old what my plans were for the weekend, I would say, party!
No, if you asked me when I was 20 years old, I wouldn't tell you.
Wow.
You know, it was always, man, weekend, 20 years old. Man, the whole world is out there. And Sandy, you're free. Man.
Yeah.
It's kind of just a different kind of young guy. He's an old. You remember what they used to say about he's got an old spirit about him? Yeah, I think he's got an old spirit about him.
Yeah, I mean,
Connor, I don't sell Connor short.
Yeah.
I'm not selling him short. Probably once he leaves here, he's going to be that 20-year-old guy with bright eyes and, you know.
No, I'm just tired. I've been here since 5. So
maybe he's like a lot of 20-year-olds. He started his weekend on Thursday.
Yeah. Night. Yeah. Hey, every day's a weekend for me, pretty much.
So you've been here since 5. You're tired. Let's see.
Yeah, that's it.
He's been here since 5. That's 6, 7, 8. That's 3 hours. And you're tired already. You probably didn't get much sleep either, right?
I mean, I don't know. I usually don't get regular until like 11 about.
Okay.
I'm just tired for the first 3 hours because I don't like drink coffee or anything.
Yeah.
I don't like, you know, drink like an energy drink.
Well, you know what, man?
I didn't
drink coffee until I was in my 30s. Sandy, you've been a coffee drinker as a young guy?
I think you start drinking coffee probably like young people start smoking. It's fashionable. It doesn't taste good. It's not that good, but it's cool.
Yeah.
So I probably started drinking coffee while I was in college and probably didn't enjoy it that much.
Yeah. Well, you know, I started drinking coffee because I'd be on my way to work and I found out it opened your eyes, and so I'm not a big coffee drinker. I'll drink one cup of coffee a day. I drink it early in the morning when I first get up, and then that's it. Sandy, you drink coffee throughout the day?
No, I stopped drinking caffeine, and when I stopped using caffeine, I found out I didn't really like coffee, so I was doing the same. I was doing the same thing you were.
Yeah, right. All right. So, I mean, a lot of things to talk about as always. Kind of gloomy outside and going to be that way for the balance of the day. But so many different things to talk about, Sandy. And, you know, I want to begin. No, I don't want to begin there. Because I don't want to jump right into the doom and gloom of the economy. But I'm going to do it anyway, Sandy. There are food lines again in this country. Soup lines. And you look and you see it. And yes, people are having trouble feeding their families again. That can't be a good harbinger, man, for Democrats as they move into this, 2022 midterm elections, can it?
Well, I mean, unemployment is still at basically an all-time low. So, you know, to the extent there are food lines, when you're unemployed, it doesn't matter how many people are unemployed if you are.
Right.
And I suspect that those are the people who are finding themselves in food lines. But with the increase in prices, I mean, the fact is that regardless of the cause of economic problems, when things are hurting economically, it tends to hurt the incumbent. And, you know, inflation was over 9% last month. So that is a skyrocketing level of inflation. And, you know, the politicians and the people who had a vested interest in not seeing inflation on the horizon were definitely closing their eyes to it a year ago, because all of the things were in place to cause it. And lots of them are not governmental, but at least we could have been more realistic about the fact that it was in the offing. The biggest problem right now for inflation is shortage. And you know, shortage is not something created by governments, other than maybe the warfare that it's helping to create some of the food shortages.
But Sandy, people are still spending. They're still buying. And so I thought that when you're in a climate like this, and historically people would not be spending and buying, they would be conserving.
Well, I think durable goods sales have gone down a bit since their peak. I think there's evidence that people are, but you know, one of the reasons for inflation is spiking so high is the cost of housing and the cost of energy, both of which are significant components of the breadbasket that's considered when we measure the consumer price index and inflation. So, you know, there's not much choice. That the flexibility and demand for energy and for housing is pretty low. People are going to have to spend that money, and they're going to have to bid the price up if they want to buy it.
So, Sandy, are we now officially in recession? What is the official?
I think it's two quarters in a row. I don't think we're there, but I think everyone thinks that we're technically going to get there in the not too distant future. I think everyone thinks that recession is the unfortunate pill that solves inflation, and the more you look at it, the more you realize that some of the philosophers who doubted the viability of capitalism, it did have one thing right, which is that the business cycle tends to have the biggest impact on Tom, Dick, and Mary. People who have assets and can accumulate value in assets, you know, if you lose half your money, but you start out with $100 million, you still have $50 million. You don't feel as rich as you did last year, but you still got plenty of money. But if you don't have any assets and everything you purchase has gone up in price by 10 or 12%, you definitely feel poor, and you are poor.
You know, Sandy, so there's two different sides to the coin in this, and that's as you talk about the people who can withstand this and you know, they've already got nest eggs and this is basically much ado about nothing. They will survive it. And then the other side of the equation, the other side of the coin, is a tremendous number of people who are terrified right now.
Well, I mean, I think what you're going to identify is if you are living paycheck to paycheck, okay,
right,
which means that you're basically spending all the money that you bring home month to month, then inflation is going to hurt you because, you know, you are already spending all your money and now the stuff that you're buying has gone up in price by 9%. So now you're 9% short. You know, now you have to start making decisions about what you buy. that begin to pinch you. So, you know, a very large percentage of Americans live paycheck to paycheck. We figured out that certainly you do if you earn the median income, which is $75,000. You're living paycheck to paycheck. That's half of the families in the United States. But then there were articles that suggest that families that earn two and even three times that median income still are likely to be living paycheck to paycheck.
So, Sandy, that's the segment of the population that right now is feeling this, and it hasn't even begun to sting yet. I mean, it's stinging somewhat, but we're looking down the road at the fact that it hasn't even been declared yet.
Well, I mean, the sting comes when people jobs start shrinking, the number of jobs, and we don't have that effect yet. But inflation is going to take money out of everyone's pocket. Essentially, it makes their dollars worth less, and then the recession that is the pill that is either it is both caused by and the cure for inflation will start taking paychecks away from people too. So that's kind of a double whammy. We haven't experienced the second half of that whammy, but it's likely hanging out there.
So this article in today's Wall Street Journal, Wells Fargo quarterly profit declines 48%. Now, for most of us who, you know, or that doesn't affect us at all, but it is a major sign, right? I mean, 48% decline.
Well, financial institutions tend to ride a little bit of a different crest. However, financial institutions in periods of inflation can do quite well. It really depends on the demand for the products that they make money on and also the ways in which they might have been speculating and losing. I haven't looked at the breakdown of their earnings, but I suspect some of that involves losses they've experienced not in their commercial lending, but in other sectors of the banking.
But does that have impact on the overall system that we're talking about?
Not so much.
Okay. All right. Got to go to a break. 844-967-2789 is the number. It's Friday. That means Fridays with Sandy Williams. You can join us. We'll be right back. Welcome back to the Earl Ingram Show. As always, you can join us at 844-967-2789. That's 844-967-2789. You can text us at the same numbers. Friday, it means Fridays with Sandy Williams. So, Sandy, I want to go back to the economy and that 9% inflation rate. The feds are talking about raising, the rate 0.75% again. Mm-hmm. And so they have no other choice, right? Because that inflation rate is unsustainable. I mean, it will destroy the economy and whatever parts of the economy are still moving
the problem with high inflation is that it drives you to higher inflation. It's a spiral. It's an upward spiral, because when you think prices are going up 9%, and that makes you spend the money faster. You know, you want to buy it today rather than 2 months from now, because it'll cost more 2 months from now. So you end up having a more frantic bidding process for everything in the near term, which ramps that inflation rate up even higher. So it is basic economic policy that you try and hit inflation over the head with a big 2x4. And that's what they're doing when they increase the Federal Reserve rate by 0.75%. They're hitting it over the head with a 2x4, but that 2x4 has the impact of driving you in the direction of recession. It's taking money out of the pocket of spenders, and it's forcing people to look at the future in a more pessimistic way in terms of their opportunity to participate in it. So, economists, one of the basic premises is that the cure for inflation is recession. And you know, the Fed tries to walk a very fine line, and they talk about it now, a soft landing. And there's a real art form to a soft landing, which hasn't really been figured out yet.
So what is impacted immediately when we talk about those rates rising the way they are is mortgage lending and mortgage rates, and that's the first shoe to drop. Am I right or wrong?
No, you're right. And mortgage rates actually went up quite rapidly, and then over the last month they tailed off a little bit because of the demand for, lots of people were refinancing, so the demand for mortgages was pretty high because people were refinancing their higher loan rates into lower loan rates. Well, that stopped because the mortgage rates caught up to the outstanding mortgage rates, so refinancing slowed down. There still is a shortage of housing, and so that shortage of housing has curtailed the rate at which people can buy new housing and enter into new mortgages. So for a while, there was a bit of a slowdown in the demand for new mortgage financing. But yeah, it's going to definitely affect the cost of housing. It's going to affect the cost of buying a house. And the other thing it'll affect is the cost of installment debt. So most people buy cars on installment debt. And while cars are in short supply now, so that the demand for installment debt to buy cars has tailed off a bit, it definitely will impact the purchase of expensive, durable goods like automobiles.
Let me ask you, Sandy, because most of us are not economists and we don't understand. So if you took a loan out prior to any of these things happening, that loan is secure with the interest rate that it has. It doesn't matter what's happened, or can that be impacted and affected at all by what's happening now?
Well, it depends. Some people got mortgages that were variable rate mortgages,
right.
And that was because they were paying a lower rate in the near term. But the mortgage, the lenders had the option to increase the rate on the mortgage depending on the Federal Reserve rate and the prime rate. And so those rates are not secure. But the more common way to finance a home was to get a 15 or 30 year fixed rate mortgage. And those fixed rate mortgages, so long as you keep it intact, you don't sell the house and pay off the loan, those rates are intact for the life of the mortgage. So there are people who have made 30 year mortgages when they bought their house a year ago at a very low rate. And so long as they stay in that house, that mortgage is going to be right there at that low rate.
So what about automobiles and those kinds of things? Can that change?
No, automobile rates typically are not variable rate. So those installment loans have fixed rate, but they're relatively short-term loans.
Right.
They've gotten longer, and people have worried about that. People are buying cars with 5 and 6 year loans now, which are long-term loans to buy an asset that doesn't have a life that's greatly in excess of that number of years.
Sandy, this 9.1% inflation rate, haven't seen that since the 80s, is what they're saying. But you know, in the back of my mind, you know, because I remember that so well, that time so well, and I always, during these last, how long has it been going, man? We've been doing so great for since 2000 and what? 10?
From 2000 to 2008, we had a very good, strong economy. Interest rates weren't as low. The financial collapse of late 2007 drove interest rates way down to essentially
zero.
And theoretically negative levels. And ever since then, we've had very low interest rates. And unfortunately, even Wall Street, that's supposed to be shrewd, gets used to something, and instead of projecting a norm out into the future that reflects a norm in the past, they start projecting current experience out into the future. Nobody who had any gray hair at all thought that 1% and 2% interest was going to be a long-term prevailing rate of interest.
Yeah, I mean, it just, you just get carried away, and your mind plays tricks on you, and you think that that's, you know, that's the norm, and you get into that. And now, really, we're going back to what would be the norm, right? Is it safe to say, Sandy, that 4 or 5% interest is?
Yeah. Between 4 and 5% would be the average mortgage rate over an extended 50 or 60 year period of time. And so, you know, that is something that would be, it should be expected over the long term. But even Wall Street, the people who are valuing stock, began to value stock premised on a long-term premise of low interest. And then when interest rates went up, the stock price went down. Like, what were they thinking? You know?
Yeah. Well,
stock should be valued on long-term expectations.
All right. We've got to go to a break. 844-967-2789 is the number. My guest is Sandy Williams. It's Friday. We'll be back.
Till you use me up. Until you use me up. It's been a long time coming, but I know a change gonna come. Oh, yes it will.
All right, welcome back to the Earl Ingram Show. As always, you can join us at 844-967-2789. That's 844-967-2789. You can text us at that same number. You know, Sandy, I'm starting to worry about myself. You know, earlier in the week, we had a conversation about whether or not I would think about getting a booster shot for COVID. But now I'm all in on getting a booster shot. What is going on, man?
What's going on in your head?
Yeah.
I'm reluctant to go there.
But all of a sudden a light came on. And so I've been wrestling with this, and the question becomes, I had the vaccinations before,
mm-hmm.
because the same thing happened. I was wrestling with whether or not I should get the vaccinations. I got the vaccinations. Nothing changed with me. I didn't feel ill or sick. They didn't impact me in any negative way. I was protected. I mean, and people around me were protected. And then that same thinking came back, and it got warm and said, okay, well, I don't need that anymore. And now I'm looking around and I'm watching and I'm reading and I'm saying, I can't wait to get back and get a vaccination. What is going on with me?
Well, that's all right. That's not stinking thinking. I mean, first of all, you know, like I've said, I think vaccination is more of a decision that ought to be made for community reasons rather than
right.
personal reasons. I mean, I think the personal vaccination determination in a situation when we aren't in a public emergency is really just a private decision. You know, what risks are you willing to take? And how risky is the vaccination? Now, you know, there's some modicum of risk with a vaccination, but millions, tens of millions, hundreds of millions of people have been vaccinated, and the level of side effects from that has apparently been quite low. So, you know, I think when this new strain is coming out, hospitalizations are going up. We don't yet have any hospital systems that are apparently threatened with serious overcrowding from it, but, you know, it sounds like you're just thinking sensibly, Earl, which is that's a refreshing concept.
You know, but Sandy, you can't help but read the tea leaves, right? I mean, we know what's coming, and so, you know, I'm certainly going to go in early next week.
Well, did you get vaccinated for the flu?
Yeah, I did. First time.
Okay, well, I mean, I think the decision, absent an emergency in the medical system, the decision about getting vaccinated for COVID is much like the decision about getting vaccinated for the flu. As we get older, the danger from flu increases. As we get older, the danger from contracting COVID gets higher. So it sounds like a very reasonable personal decision to decide that you'd want to get vaccinated, as particularly this new COVID strain that appears to be very transmissible seems to be taking a grip. And furthermore, it's telling us, the data is telling us that this new strain can evade the immunity that has been created by, for instance, prior infections, and that the people who are vaccinated, while they still probably contract the new version, don't get very sick. So, okay, that's a lot of data. That data seems to suggest that it's probably pretty smart to consider getting vaccinated again.
Yeah, you know, and as opposed to waiting until we see what we know is coming, is going to come. And so, you know, well, maybe Sandy, this white hair that I have, there's a reason for having it, right? I mean, I don't know if we get it.
Yeah. You mean you get it from years of experience.
Yeah.
And some of them horrifying.
Yeah.
Right? That's when it gets white. You're using good thoughts, good thinking. I think that, like I said before in the prior show, I think the messaging about vaccination was very, very faulty from the government and from the public service folks who were trying to explain it. Should have explained that it the mandate for it is not to preserve your own individual health; it's to preserve the health of the public health system and the hospital system. When those aren't at risk, then it's much more of a personal decision. But I think even as on a personal basis, the decision to get vaccinated is altogether rational.
Any fear at all of the monkeypox?
No, I haven't yet developed that fear.
No. But, you know, the first time, you hear the first case, second case, third case, fourth case, we just get to a point where we're terrified of everything, Sandy, right? I mean, we really are. You know, I'm reading about the monkeypox, and I never gave it a second thought. You know, I was going to go.
I think one of the things that leads us into feeling either crazy or buying into conspiracy theories is the way the news media
reports
generally deals with things, because they tend to amp up the information about something early on, because horrifying news reads much more, is much more readable, and there are many more clicks about horrifying news than there are about just kind of mellow news. And so, you know, we all tend to know that the news media might be exaggerating the danger associated with whatever it is. But then a little part of us thinks, well, maybe they aren't exaggerating it. And in the past, this stuff that came out about diseases that seemed to be an exaggeration early on turned out not to be. Sometimes it is. You know, the world risk of Ebola from this horrifying disease didn't materialize. But you know what? The world risk of COVID did, and it did pretty quickly.
You know, the last thing on this, and what really, Sandy, made me make up my mind to get the COVID shot was I'm around these boys every day, and there are 200 of them, and all these other people, and we're all in a place where you don't give it much thought, but you don't know, and so it's, you certainly don't want to be the person. And so the responsibility of it all, I guess, and the gravity of it all, Sandy, is probably, you know, something I didn't think about initially. But I certainly am thinking about it more and more every time I'm around all those boys. So, and that goes to what you say about you do that for others. not so much for yourself.
Well, and you know, when you're around indoors and around a whole bunch of people, and particularly kids who tend to be very communicable in their way they deal with one another and the way they deal with you, it makes sense for yourself too. I mean, I think there is a personal aspect of it. I think the mandate aspect of it is not based on personal health, but based on community health. But I think the personal decision is the one that you're now considering, and I think there's lots of reason to get vaccinated.
I've got something that we're going to talk about after the break. I guess we can go to it now. Sandy, I was reading an article. Chinese firms are selling Russia goods, its military needs to keep fighting in Ukraine. So the semiconductors and microchips and all those things that China is selling to Russia and are being pointed out by our government as, you know, why are you selling this to Russia? You know, we've got an issue. We don't like what Russia's doing in Ukraine. Are we in any position to tell China they shouldn't be selling these things to Russia, Sandy?
Well, we might tell them that, but incidentally, China's selling them to us too. I mean, right. we're a buyer; we're not a seller of that stuff from China. China's a central source of all that stuff. So, you know, I suppose if China decided to choke off the supply to us, we'd be in serious trouble. No, I don't think we probably are. I think that's probably political. That's political eyewash here in the United States for us to be saying those things to China, but we don't have any realistic expectation that they're gonna. You know, number one, I don't think we want to get into a sanctioning fight with China because the mutual sanction problem with China would be pretty extreme for our economy.
So when we come back, Sandy, I want to drill a little bit deeper. Got to go to a break. 844-967-2789. Text us at the same number. It's Friday. That means Fridays with Sandy Williams. We'll be right back. Welcome back to the Earl Ingram Show. As always, you can join us at 844-967-2789. That's 844-967-2789. You can text us at that same number. It's Friday. That means Friday's with Sandy Weaver. You know, Sandy, it's puzzling to me, but I guess, you know, you have to look at these kinds of things, as you stated, as, you know, political fodder, because this is what the... And U.S. Ambassador to China had to say, our government and our national leadership has been very clear to China from the onset that they should not provide material, economic, and military support for Russia in this war. Nicholas Burns, the U.S. Ambassador to China, said last week. The Commerce Department said in a written response that while it didn't believe China had sought to systematically evade U.S. export controls on Russia, the department was closely monitoring trade between the countries and will not hesitate to employ our full legal and regulatory tools against the parties that provide support to the Russian military. What can we possibly do, Sandy? I mean, what kind of leverage do we have with a nation like Russia to penalize them? Is that just talk? Is that just bravado?
You mean with China? Well,
yes. With China.
Yeah, I think it's more or less bravado. I think it's it's talk. And you know, the fact is that when you sell to Russia chips and the things, chips have a fairly generic quality to them, and it's probably not easy to prove that a chip you sold was going to be used by the buyer for military. You know, I suppose it would be the case if the company that bought the chip was only in the business of using it for military products. But whatever the case, the United States is not in a very strong position with respect to China, with respect to implementing sanctions. That I think sanctioning China in a significant way would be a bit like shooting off toes on your own feet.
Yeah.
So I think you use a gun, but you don't want to shoot your own. You don't want to shoot the toes on your own feet. And I think that's what would happen in the case of sanctioning China. The mutual sanctioning process would be very, very uncomfortable.
Let me ask you something, Sandy. Don't we in our own nation have we identified areas where we can ourselves, you know, mine the things necessary that we need as it relates to these chips and whatnot? I mean, there's certainly a lot of open spaces and land in our nation and some of the other areas that we are engaged and involved in. Can't we do more mining and
research ourselves? Well, it's interesting to hear the conservatives who criticize China for instance, subsidizing their economy and creating an unfair trade advantage for China. And in the next breath, they talk about how the United States ought to take control of the chip industry and make sure that the chips are manufactured geographically inside America, so we don't have a problem of having to import them from someone who might become hostile. And so China, I just read today, is in the process of taking control and creating a government-run business that is going to be in the business of buying metals and basically raw materials for the steel industry to try and get a grip on making sure that China has access to, at a low enough cost, the raw materials for making the strategically important steel and aluminum and things that are strategically important. We've talked about the same thing in the United States. And so when China does it, we criticize it as being sort of an unlawful form of meddling in the economy. But yet we talk about doing the same thing. You're talking about doing the same thing. You know, we're talking about how can we mine the United States more? How can we find the metals more in the United States? How can we make sure it's manufactured in the United States? Well, the market makes those decisions. You can create incentives for the market to try and make it more likely that they'll make those decisions. You can try and put your thumb on the scale to make it more expensive for them to make the decision to do it otherwise. That's called tariffs. It's complicated. And, you know, if you want to have a market process, then the government keeps its hands off. But the United States government doesn't keep its hands off our market. And we do all kinds of subsidization. And then, however, we jump up and down and cry foul when China does subsidization, which is very much like the kind of things we either do or talk about wanting to do.
You know, Sandy, prior to my conversations with you, I got to tell you, the markets, I never thought much at all about the markets, right? I mean, my entire life, I never saw the world through that prism of the markets and how important they were and how much they impacted and affected our lives. But the more I see that, the more I now spend time looking at those things, it's almost like, man, that's so critical of so critical importance to all of us that as many of us as can should know that these our lives are at the whims sometimes of those markets.
Well, our lives are supported by, facilitated by, our standard of living is nurtured by, and we're dependent on markets where there's choice being made by many, many market participants. And, you know, we spent a long time criticizing back in the Soviet period the central planning that was attempted by the Politburo and in the central government of Russia. And before China broke from the Mao version of communism, the central planning and 5 and 10 year planning of China, we laughed at it because the fact is central planning doesn't work. You know, you can't make the decisions that need to be made by all the participants out there in the marketplace. The million feet of the millipede need to know where each one is to operate. And so, you know, markets are much more effective than central planning. But markets have defects too. You know, it's sort of like a Hobson's choice. What is the best worst thing? You know, what's the best way to do it? And you've got a bunch of choices, all of which have advantages and disadvantages. And I think the world experience has demonstrated that markets that are properly monitored by and regulated by the government are probably the best way for most economic decisions to get made.
You know, and the last thing about it before we go to break is the markets inside of our own nation in a time where those were the measuring stick, those are no longer the measuring stick. You know, and it's the global market. And whether we want to accept that or not, that's it.
Yeah, I mean, since, you know, after World War II, like I've said frequently, you know, the U.S. market was sort of the world market as far as manufacturing was concerned, and buying and selling of manufactured goods. And slowly over time, that evolved. By 1975, we began to have a much more clear-cut impact in the U.S. economy of worldwide competitors, particularly in Europe and Japan. And ever since then, it's become much clearer that the world is a massive marketplace in which the United States is a participant and is not necessarily dominant.
You know, Sandy, we don't hear much about Japan. It's rare now that we hear much about Japan and the markets and those kinds of things. Did they ever come out of their quagmire?
Well, they've never really solved their recession, but Japan remains one of the top five economies in the world. And it is a very big participant in the world economy. It just hasn't been a rapidly growing economy for the past while. But, you know, it is a very significant participant.
Yeah. You know, I remember when Japan and everybody was talking about Japan like they're talking about China now. And whether it was a bubble that burst or whatever it was, you know, it has never been able to rise back to the lofty heights that it had in those 1980s. And I was just wondering if that had changed, and you just clarified that. Anyway, got to go to a break. When we come back, we'll continue the conversation. It's Friday. That means Fridays with Sandy Williams. You're tuned into the Earl Ingram Show. We'll be right back.